So, Mike, are you going to heaven?
No.
There might be some people out there who disagree with that. How about you, Becky?
I don't know. It depends what Francis says.
Yeah, and you put the nail right on the head. This is Ask an Atheist, 253-584-1480. And we'll be talking about humanistic Judaism this hour, which should be interesting. But first, we need to talk about what the Pope said this week, which is practically a segment for us. But to be honest, it's an interesting one this week. Religious people and atheists alike were surprised when Pope Francis made a statement last month in which he seemed to suggest that even atheists would go to heaven if they did good deeds. Vatican spokesman Thomas Rosica clarified the issue in a message on Vatican Radio last week, explaining that when the Pope spoke of the redemption, he wasn't talking about non-Catholics going to heaven, but having the opportunity to go to heaven if they became Catholics. He also stressed that the people who know of the Church but do not join it or stay in it cannot find salvation. So that's the response to it, but then before that, which we haven't talked about, Pope Francis actually said if you're a good person, you still go to heaven even if you're not Catholic.
Well, specifically he said that you are redeemed, and which means is that there is a place in the timeshare that you can buy into.
Yeah.
And he never straight out said you're going to heaven. It was interpreted that way. And I think a lot of it is that people want to like this Pope, especially after the last one is essentially Darth Benedict.
Yeah, I think Darth Benedict left a really bad taste in there. I'm not even going to finish that. And so they're looking for somebody who's nicer, and they want this guy who doesn't spend a lot of money, doesn't dress up like a runway Wizard of Oz.
Looks more like your grandpa than a monster.
Exactly.
I think that's a big part of it is I think, and I may be a conspiracy theorist in this.
Uh-oh, here we go.
But this is actually a genuine thought that I had, and it's speculation, and I could be completely wrong. But I suspect, one, the people that elected this Pope was actually far more conservative and traditionalist than the group that elected the last one, Mr. Monsterface.
Yeah.
So, now
that
we have
a lot of the same folks that elected this Pope?
Yes, in less than 10 years. It's the same people plus the people who've been put in place by Monsterface to elect this guy.
So, I see.
So essentially you have a group of people who are also in a tailspin of PR disasters. So here's what I'm thinking. The Pope, whatever he says, is going to make news. So what if the Pope says something vague that can be interpreted in a friendly way, and then, much in the same way that a pediatrician won't give you the shot, they'll have a nurse do it so that you can still like the pediatrician.
Yeah.
What if he says something that's vague, but it can be interpreted in a nice way, and then somebody comes in later and then says, well, actually, what the Pope meant to say was, and then they splash cold water on your face, but because it's not the Pope saying it, it gets less press.
I think I'm going to side with the conspiracy theory end of that. That seems a little bit too complex to me. Never ascribe to malice what can be attributed to stupidity, basically. I think what you're seeing here is they ordered a bill of goods by voting this guy in, and they may not be getting what they wanted. I mean, they're getting somebody who's definitely conservative. The Catholic Church, the leadership of the Catholic Church is leaning more and more conservative, almost in response to the parishioners themselves becoming more less and less conservative. So in that case, I think they were hoping they would get somebody in the tradition of Palpatine or Benedict, and eventually end up with somebody, you know, in that same tradition, but because it looked like it, but then he got here, and maybe he's not saying that. This could be a good thing. I guess what I'm saying is this could be a good thing.
Could it actually be that the Pope was kind of inadvertently saying there are many paths to God or many paths to tradition or to redemption, and then say, wait, everyone interpreted that? I didn't actually mean that. Could it actually be the Pope backtracking and then sending his spokesman out to just say, no, this is what the Pope really meant? Or do you think that this was someone else saying, oh, no?
But this could be a little bit, you know, better late than never. But hasn't the Catholic Church been tacitly saying that, you know, other religious people are also human beings and also can get salvation, too, for a long time? I mean, they say that and they go at the end, oh, yeah, but you have to be Catholic in order to get it. But I think that's window dressing at this point.
It sort of reminds me of a joke that Stephen Colbert told a long time ago. He says, well, you know, there's all these people, there's Jews and Hindus and Muslims in the world. You know, there's many ways for people to come to heaven as by accepting Jesus Christ as their Lord and Savior.
Exactly.
It's really kind of that bit. And I think this is the problem that I kind of have with people's reactions to this new Pope, is that people kind of project on him what they want to see.
Yeah.
And after the last guy was so abjectly and almost egregiously terrible, on almost any way, unapologetically terrible, that they want this guy to be different, and they don't actually look at what he does a lot of them. He does talk about the poor a lot. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
He doesn't organize massive nationwide rallies to help poor people. He does, in fact, though, when Argentina was passing same-sex marriage, organize rallies against gay rights.
Yeah, I don't see, I have a trouble seeing Benedict as terrible in the context of what popes are.
Yeah.
If he's terrible, to me, that's just like, okay, he's a pope, let's move on. I mean, we got the Borgia popes, we've got the guy, the pope from World War II, whose name I can never remember, I think it's Urban, I don't know.
I mean, he's never put a dead former pope on trial the way that's been done before. he's not slaughtering people.
Yeah.
He's not putting people under, well, he did put somebody under house arrest.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's not as overtly terrible because of the limitations on the popes in the current era versus
right.
the time when they were like a king.
Yeah,
for
much
I'm
under
of
no illusions that they're not a force, you know, they're not a force for good. But it's, you know how it is. I just when you have that historical knowledge about how terrible the Catholic Church has been, it's hard to see somebody who just says stupid things as evil.
But it's amazing how people want to see this guy as Nelson Mandela, and
right.
it's amazing how apologetic they are about stuff that they weren't willing to see before.
I'm not challenging that.
Oh,
at all.
Oh, I know. I'm not arguing with you. I'm arguing with the mythical person outside of the room who's like, oh, he's not so bad. He's kind of like the Dalai Lama. Well, no. Read some of the stuff he has to say about gay people and how he believes that a loving gay couple adopting a child is child abuse. That's falsely not true. What he says about condoms. None of the social war stuff that these guys spend millions of dollars a year to fight for, this guy is not a change on.
Yeah, well, I think the answer to the question is we are in agreement, the Catholics and I and you, that we're not going to heaven when we die, but so there we are.
Yeah.
Fair enough. Moving on, speaking of not going to heaven, there's an atheist monument at a courthouse, which is weird to me. I bet there's a lot of people going, huh? What? Don't we fight these monuments? But there's something interesting here. At the end of this month, American Atheists will unveil a new monument in front of the Bradford County, Florida courthouse. A 1,500-pound granite bench engraved with quotations from Thomas Jefferson, Madeline Murray O'Hare, Benjamin Franklin, and others will sit adjacent to an existing monument featuring the Ten Commandments. The installation follows a settlement from a 2012 suit against Bradford County about the Ten Commandment monument. The bench will be the first atheist-sponsored monument to go on government property in the United States. So, I guess this is an answer of, well, if you have to have a monument of the Ten Commandments, you also have to have monuments to other belief systems, and so the American Atheist paid to have a bench put in.
Yeah, it's with a grant from the Todd Stiefel Foundation. It's pretty interesting because
Todd.
This really says, I think the ruling was, hey, you know what, there was a foundational sort of importance of the Ten Commandments in our country and in our legal system, which one can argue how important that actually was.
Very little.
And, you know, and so here I say, hey, you know, quotations from the Treaty of Tripoli, this also was foundational in our country's formation, and they are atheistic. They are specifically about the separation of church and state.
Yeah.
They are non-sectarian, and this was equally important, and so it deserves recognition at a county courthouse.
What I'm hoping for is, if you live in Bradford County, Florida, and you're a Muslim or a Jew or, you know, of the Baha'i faith or whatever, if you're not represented at the courthouse in Jefferson County, Florida, and you would like to be, please do so. I want to see so many monuments at this courthouse that it becomes unusable as a courthouse, and it starts looking like the Fortress of Solitude.
I was thinking Bradford County Sculpture Garden.
Yeah, at which point, you know, they're going to have to get rid of all of the monuments, which I think, I honestly don't really, as a response to the Ten Commandments, I'm okay with it. But I don't like the idea of a monument to any belief system or lack of belief system on government property.
Well, that's the point here. The difference between the difference between what the American Atheist group is doing and the people, probably a church that donated the Ten Commandments statue, is that the Ten Commandments statue donating church wants to put it there as a piece of evidence and a stamp of ownership of Christianity owning the United States and the
right.
United States form of government. That's the reason that they want to put God in the Pledge of Allegiance and all these other things, and why when you have a up-and-coming politician like Marco Rubio at the last Republican convention, actually cited those things
yeah.
as proof that we're a Christian
but
nation.
That's not surprising. That's not news. We all know that.
Yeah. My point being, of course, that the reason that American Atheist is doing it is not so they can go, no, it's an atheist thing. They're not doing that at all. What they're doing is saying, okay, legally, you can put it there as long as it's there for educational purposes, not, you know, proselytizing purposes. And for it to be educational, everybody has to be included.
Yeah.
And the whole point is that, like you say, Sam, your magical Fortress of Solitude statue garden is going to lead to somebody getting angry and they say, fine, we can't have nice things, get rid of all of them.
Which I think is a superior result.
Yeah, it reminds me a lot of the Bible distribution and atheist literature distribution at the schools in Florida as well. Florida seems to be a hot spot for this kind of thing.
That back in the TV days, we had a caller who said the farther north you go in Florida, the farther south you go in Florida.
Mm-hmm. Something like that, yeah.
Interesting. So,
and our guest today has also spent the last several years in Florida.
So. Oh, wow.
We're just very Florida-centric today.
But I guess, now my question is, it's a bench.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think that the ramifications for bad intentioned photos from Christians in Jefferson County is going to be? I'm going to go, you know, sit on the Madeline Murray O'Hara out of disrespect.
They're totally free to if they want to.
But what's the over under on that, I guess, is my question.
I would actually take wagers on whether it's going to be in bad people's photographs or graffitied, which I really think is going to happen. It's a question of when.
Right.
It's inevitable.
I think if we're going to have a spread on this, I think if we're going to have a fantasy fundamentalist league here.
Mm-hmm.
I think we have to vote on when they start showing disrespectful photos with the thing, when politicians start making it a point about how terrible we are, that we wanted a bench at a courthouse, and when somebody finally takes a sledgehammer to it, which we both know is coming.
Well, nobody's going to enforce any law against them doing that, even though, obviously, damaging and vandalizing stuff on the property.
I would think that if that happens, then you would have to enforce
I think it's coming.
I think the dragging their feet on it will lead to the sledgehammering because it'll escalate.
Yeah.
That if you really felt like you might get in trouble for hitting this thing with a sledgehammer, you're less likely to actually take a swing. But with the courts and everyone else going, yeah, this is Jesus land, we own it, they're probably going to be forced to by a higher court.
Can I be on record by saying I don't think anyone should take a sledgehammer to monuments on county land?
I think we can make that clear that we're in favor of the monument, but we want somebody to take a sledgehammer to it? Don't make us look that terrible, Becky.
There are better ways to take these things down than actual violence.
Yeah, adding more monuments.
Lawsuits didn't work, so maybe
adding more monuments. That's the solution. We have an email. This comes to us from Rick from Missouri, and he writes, I'm in a friendly debate with a friend who's a Christian about homosexual marriage. I mentioned that most people use parts of the Bible they like and ignore the rest. She replied by stating that only those with faith can successfully interpret the Bible. Does this end the debate, or should I try a different tack?
Well played.
Yeah.
You can only argue this if you believe it. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
I think that's such a cop-out, because the truth is that American Christians nowadays are going to have very different attitudes than American Christians 20 or 30 years from now, including on this very topic of same-sex marriage. And there will be a time where they're like, what do you mean? That doesn't say that. It doesn't mean that. The same way that 200 years ago there were Christians saying that because it says in the Bible slavery is okay, then they use that as an explicit argument in favor of slavery. You look now, you're not seeing a lot of Christian slave owners in the United States anymore.
The faith you can't understand because you don't have faith is a cop-out. When this has played, Rick, you've already won.
Mm-hmm.
You can declare victory and go away. Now, keep in mind, the person you're debating with is already going to declare victory and walk away. But the facts of the matter is, the evidence here, is that she basically had to say what she is saying here is there is no rational basis for what I believe, that you, in order to understand what I believe, in order to understand my holy book, you already have to leave the field of rationality. At that point, this is no longer a debate. There's no structure for it. There's no way anything can be purchased. She's made it about feelings. He or she has made it about feelings. And you've won.
You know, many people who use this line will also argue that atheism is a religion and that you have to have faith to be an atheist. So you could sort of hack the conversation that way and say, all right, you think I have faith?
I think I spent 20 minutes on that one a couple days ago. I will never accept you have to have faith to be an atheist. That's not how atheism works.
I would not accept it either. I just think that if this debater that you're engaging with would take that, you could try and play that and turn it around on her.
Yeah, I think so. This is Ask an Atheist, 253-584-1480. When we come back, we're going to talk about humanistic Judaism. Blah.
Need a break from the theistic world?
Live in the Seattle area?
Like the Flying Spaghetti Monster?
Whether you're an ardent non-believer, steadfast agnostic, or marauding Pastafarian, check out the award-winning nonprofit organization Seattle Atheists.
Socialize at the Third Thursday Meetup, attend lectures, come camping, donate blood.
Connect at seattleatheists.org.
Seattle Atheists, we believe in you.
Out of the briny depths of the internet comes a comic book podcast so powerful it cannot be contained by a single continent. Mike and Paul, save the universe!
I'm Mike Gillis.
And I'm Paul Root.
If you're an unsatisfied comics fan, we want to help you find better comics.
And if you've never picked up a comic before in your life, we want to help you find what could be your new favorite thing.
On Mike and Paul Save the Universe, we love the bejesus out of comics, and so should you.
Find us online at mikeandpaul.com.
Billy, I am the Queen of England. You must give me your lunch money.
Why?
Because a minute will explode.
I don't know.
I'm the Queen of England. I know things.
Well, that makes sense. Here you go.
Wait, Billy. Just because an authority says it doesn't make it true. Come to Camp Quest Northwest, where you'll learn critical thinking and science in a fun-filled week-long nature camp.
No!
Camp Quest Northwest can be found at campquestnorthwest.org. Donations and volunteers accepted. The devil is not real.
I'm melting!
Looking to buy or sell a home or other property in Edmonton, Alberta, or surrounding areas? Demand a professional and call Don Summers of Professional Realty Group at 780-237-4718 or visit dndrealty.ca and discover how he works with you to achieve your goals, save you time, and protect your investment. Don Summers of Professional Realty Group. It's time you hired a professional.
You can advertise on Ask an Atheist on the radio, on our website, and in our podcast. People just like you who have the same interests are listening right now, just like you are, and thousands will download this podcast and listen to it later. If you have a product, service, or idea to sell, people here in the Pacific Northwest and people around the world, thousands will hear your message. Let us help you sell your product, service, or idea. Contact us at advertising@askanatheist.tv. That's advertising@askanatheist.tv.
Welcome back. This is Ask an Atheist, 253-584-1480. This hour, we're talking about humanistic Judaism. But first, I would like to thank everybody to help us, who is helping us keep the lights on by responding to Peggy's challenge. I'd like to thank Robert in Crescent, Pennsylvania, Harley in Switzerland, Richard in Chesapeake, Virginia, and once again, Anik in the Netherlands. Thank you all very much for keeping the show going. It's really important. If you would like to participate in Peggy's challenge, you can go to askanatheist.tv, and on the right-hand side, there's a yellow button to contribute to the show, and like I said, every dollar you give goes directly to producing the show. Thank you very much. So we do have a very interesting interview this hour. We have it's something we've talked about. Becky comes from a Jewish background.
I do. Yeah, and I grew up observant, but within the Reform movement.
Yeah, and one of the interesting things that a lot of atheists who come from a Christian background don't understand is sort of the interface between religion and culture with being a Jew, and that there are Jews out there who don't believe in God at all, but go to temple and participate. And to talk about that a little bit and his path to it, we've got Rabbi Jeffrey Falik. He was ordained in the Reform Jewish movement in 1989 and now identifies as a secular humanistic Jewish rabbi. He's the incoming rabbi of the Birmingham Temple in Farmington Hills, Michigan, and he blogs at theatheistrabbi.com. How you doing today?
Good afternoon. How are you?
Very good.
Yeah, lovely to have you on today, Jeff. Despite being raised in a largely secular household, and you've got a background in cognitive psychology, and you're currently an atheist, you at some point believed in God. So what drew you to the rabbinate?
Well, I believed in the idea of God. I think that's the best I can put it. I thought it was a really good idea, really a wonderful metaphor. There were times I struggled with, you know, the embodiment of that idea. I think when you use God language, you get sucked into God reality. But I think my interest was really a Jewish cultural interest, and combined with that, a sort of realization that, well, Jews taught God, so I guess that's the language I have to use.
So what led you then to accepting atheism as more logical?
Well, over time, it became very clear to me after I tried all different kinds of alternatives, namely the what's called the Kaplanian approach, which is named for Rabbi Mordechai Kaplan, who was the founder of Reconstructionist Judaism. I began to realize, and I'll talk about that in a minute, I began to realize that this was just language games and tricks and shticks that didn't really have any any substance to them. Now, Kaplan was a non-theist, he was a non-supernaturalist. And his idea about Judaism was that it was a civilization, a culture, but he loved that God language, as appropriate for a person who was born in the 19th century and grew up as an Orthodox Jew. And he really felt that we could transform this language into something more representative of the inner impulses of humanity. I'm sure you guys have explored these ideas. It's sort of a Dewey idea. He didn't come up with it himself, but he applied it Jewishly. And this was very exciting for me. And there are many rabbis out there who hold this ideology. The problem, of course, is the issue of cognitive dissonance. If you continue to talk to God and address God and praise God and worship God, well, evidently at some point you're going to start thinking about God in some kind of more traditional or more, I guess, what we would call familiar way. And this became a huge headache for me. It became very difficult for me to stand in front of people or to teach things that I was using the language, blessed are you, God, who has commanded us to light these candles, and thinking inside my mind, blessed is that impulse inside humanity that calls itself God that has commanded us. It was nonsense. And at this point, I just gave up on it.
The intellectual judo became a bit too much for you.
A little bit too much, yeah.
So you mentioned the dissonance between the God reality and the God language. Is that what you're talking about, that cognitive dissonance?
That's exactly it. And when I became privileged to discover this incredible ideology or idea of secular humanistic Judaism, I finally realized that I didn't have to engage in these mental gymnastics any longer. I could say what I mean and mean what I say and be who I am. And that was a marvelously liberating experience for me.
So, I guess I gotta stand in here, and I'll be honest with you, this is more than just an intellectual interest to me, given that I'm married to Becky. But, let's just start out with a real basic one here. How can one be Jewish without believing in God?
Well, I'm Jewish, and I don't believe in God, so there you go. You know, Becky might have heard throughout time, there are plenty of non-theists. I'll use non-theists as sort of a general catch-all. You know, Albert Einstein, David Ben-Gurion, Golda Meir, Mahatma Am. There is an enormously long line. And of course, much of the speculative thinking began with a Jew named Benedict Baruch Spinoza. And I think you guys are probably familiar with what he contributed to the discussion.
Oh, yeah.
The fact is that religion is made up. We made it up as we went along. And also everything else we do is made up. It all comes from the human imagination, and we create structures and we create ways to live things. Once it's attributed to the Almighty, then all of a sudden you feel very obligated to these things. But once you subtract the Almighty and all these issues of external authority, you begin to look at it for what it really is. And then you can start appreciating the parts that are nice. You can embrace the parts that you like. You can adamantly reject the parts that you're not into. And the fact is, you know, I'm Jewish because I came from a Jewish family. I welcome anybody else who considers themselves Jewish to join. My primary identity is as a human being. But this is the culture that I participate in. I can't be every kind of person all at once. I'm a male. I'm gay. I'm also a Jew. These are things that just define my personal identity, and my community's identity is part of that.
There's something that I watch out for, which you just did, and I really want to thank you for that, is you pointed out I'm a humanist, you pointed out your identity as a human to, you know, the larger human population. And when that's for everybody, who still has this sort of religious or makes a connection to a culture, that's something I really like to watch out for. And so thanks for that.
I guess, Jeffrey, the thought that kind of confuses me, and I'm somebody who, I did not come from a Jewish background, so it's something I don't quite understand. My understanding of Judaism mostly comes from comparative religion courses that I've taken. And my understanding is that Judaism at its heart is a covenant between a tribe and a deity. And I guess I wonder what, when you, like you said, it's made up. It's not something that you don't believe in the supernatural. So when you toss that aside, what's actually left?
Well, there's many things that are left. For instance, there's holidays, which can be reinterpreted and understood as things that, as events that have currency for our lives today. There's life cycle, which again, these things have to be reinterpreted and examined critically. But these are things that people need. People want to get married. People need to get buried. People want to celebrate their children's coming of age. Judaism provides me with sort of a matrix for that. This idea that it's always and eternally been this covenant between this people and its deity, that's not even historically accurate. The Bible is obsessed with all of the false gods, supposed false gods, that the Jewish people were engaged with, the ancient Israelites. This obsession in the Bible is there because it reflects a reality. There was a development of a polytheistic approach that then became a monotheistic approach, and now I guess I represent what I hope to be the post-theistic approach. We all have these needs. Now, if you look at what's going on in the Jewish world, across Israel, across this country, the vast weight of what people participate in Jewishly is secular. It's cinematic, it's literary, it's dance, it's language, it's song. There's so much more. Certainly it's holiday. Certainly it's life cycle. And I'm not saying that all of these people are secular humanistic Jews. Many of them are vaguely theistic or deistic or don't even know what the heck they are. But what they really enjoy about being Jewish is exploring this heritage that they have. I love that too. And for me, that means a very critical approach to the history. Because for what it means to be a Jew for me is identical with the experience, the historical experience of the Jewish people.
Now, so much of the Jewish people's history is defined by these external pressures that sort of separate Jews within, you know, they're wandering without a homeland, things like that. And in your blog, theatheistrabbi.com, you criticize the ghetto mentality of religious Jewish circles. Do you think that those are related? Is that where that comes from? Or can you explain what you mean by the ghetto mentality?
Well, the ghetto mentality is a part of my critique of the emphasis over all other values on Jewish survival and Jewish continuity, which has become the singular discussion in most Jewish, at least intellectual circles, certainly among rabbis. I should not say intellectual circles because this is not among Jewish studies, secular academics. But this idea that if we don't stay within ourselves, if we open ourselves up to what's out there, then we are not only sinning against God, because a lot of people are not comfortable with that language, so they subtract that, but we're sinning against the Jewish imperative of survival, against our ancestors. And this has become an obsession of the Jewish community. It's what leads ultra-Orthodox Jews to segregate themselves from all other Jews. It's what leads many religious Jews to criticize those who choose to marry someone outside of our culture and to expand their understanding of what it means to be a human being. I'm very in favor of intermarriage. There aren't a lot of rabbis in the world that will say that. if Jewish culture is anything, it's got to be a living thing that interacts, as it always has, with the outside world. I really believe that the world is heading toward a humanistic future.
So if one of the guiding principles then of secular Jewish humanism is Jewish identity being best preserved in a free and pluralistic environment.
Absolutely.
How does humanistic Judaism achieve that without those ghettoizing effects or ghettoizing rule sets?
Well, we use our Judaism and we use our way of being Jewish not as an organizing principle of life, but as an organizing principle of community, of celebration, of identity. Our organizing principle of life is secular humanism. That's what really matters, is our philosophy. But everybody needs a vehicle to express their philosophy. Some people who are secular humanists have no need to gather and sing the same song or celebrate life cycles, although I would argue that most of them are going to have a life cycle they're going to want recognized in some way or another. A lot of people want that, and you're seeing this now in the growth of the so-called, I know this isn't the correct term, but the so-called atheist churches, the assembly that's going on in England and the various attempts, even a lot of Unitarian Universalist congregations that are expressly non-theistic, we have these needs. And so Judaism provides us with sort of a scaffolding of culture that we can use then to express our secular humanistic and just normally human needs.
So, Jeffrey, something that I've noticed in this is a bit of a contrast, because we have friends of the show, whether it's our good friend Rich Lyons at Living After Faith, or the people we know like Jerry DeWitt and the Clergy Project. These are people who were officiants and clergy members who didn't believe in God. And when they left, I've noticed that among Christianity, it seems like there's this clean break that I am no longer Christian. I no longer have this identity. I no longer have this culture. I kind of walk away from these people who are my community, but I'm not seeing that in Judaism. And I wonder what it is that, if you could just speculate, what do you think that the difference is there? Why is it that when somebody like yourself, who's a rabbi who doesn't believe, why is it that you don't make that same clean break? Or what is it that calls you to hold on to some of this stuff and the identity?
Well, I've heard Richard Dawkins, for instance, speak about being a cultural Christian. So I'm not convinced that people who come from a Christian background won't figure this out at some point. But I think they're going to have a much more difficult experience with it. The Jewish experience is unbelievably broad and varied and wide. And I can't think of even the most ultra-Orthodox Jew at some point has to admit that there's a Jewish experience that extends beyond the relationship of God and the Jewish people. Now, I would probably have to push them pretty hard to the wall for that one. But the fact is that we have all of the elements of culture that are necessary in order to live a full and meaningful life, even without the theism. And so I guess, because most of us were raised that way, certainly the secular Jews, whether they went to a Reformed temple, I mean, Becky can probably attest to this from her own experience. My guess is Becky probably had a Seder.
Definitely. In fact, Sam prepared a Seder the first year that we were dating. It was fairly amazing.
I like the constraints on cooking. I saw it as a challenge.
So I don't get into the constraints on cooking so much, although I think
Iron Chef, matzah!
It's a fun and useful thing to talk about. But we, you know, most of us had Seders, and most of us barely got through the Haggadah because it was so meaningless. And the theistic liberal movements have attempted to try to make it more meaningful. I guess for a lot of people that works. Ultimately, for me, I wanted to have a Seder that not only was fun and family-oriented and where I heard some familiar music, but I also wanted it to talk about some issues that were raised by this holiday, issues of human freedom, including intellectual freedom, including things that are related to my secular humanistic ideology. That gives me an opportunity to do it. So being Jewish, because it's already an identity that's so much larger than any kind of specific theistic imperative, already provides that. And I just want to add something, too. In terms of this understanding of Judaism as a religion, this is something I could never really buy, for the simple reason that I can't get two Jews to agree with me or to agree with each other about what exactly are the demands of that religion or the requirements or the parameters of that religion. Every rabbi has his own thing. Every movement has their own point of view. These are multiple religions. If we were larger, we would be as varied as United Church of Christ is from the Pentecostal.
I can absolutely believe that. And I think there's what's going on here, especially this is something we talk about a lot just between the three of us. And I find a dichotomy in sort of the atheist movement between people who are okay with the concept of ritual or like the concept of ritual. Becky really likes the services. She really likes the ritual. She just doesn't believe in God. And then on the other side, which I sort of have to admit is the side I'm on, I'm not really interested in ritual. It doesn't do for me what it does for other people. As a humanistic rabbi, I imagine, do you see that dichotomy? I imagine it might be pretty striking for you.
Well, I think that it's a matter of personal taste and personal preference. There's a lot of ritual I can't stand. And if the ritual is in some ways harmful or, you know, opposed in some way to my secular humanistic view of the world, I'm not interested in it, not in the least. I assume, though, that you guys had a wedding, right?
We had an incredibly informal one that we surprised people with. It was actually at a brewery.
Okay, so
officiated by a former clergy.
You did do something. You wanted your friends and family to be there to celebrate with you, to be happy for you. You didn't just move in together and say, that's the end of it. You wanted to do something.
Well. I wanted to do something.
Okay. but that's all a matter of personal preference. And some people like to get together in groups, and some people like to have these family events. I don't know, for instance, how you guys as a couple relate to the winter holiday season, but I rarely found anybody who didn't get into it from some angle, because people kind of like it. I mean, it's beautiful. Whether it's a Hanukkah-y thing, or it's a Christmassy, or it's a combination, people like that. So but I think that's really a matter of personal taste and preference. You know, some people like spicy food, some people don't. Jews, I think, do like to get together and celebrate. It's a kind of a Jewishy thing. It's a culturally Jewish thing. That's what I always heard from people, even before I was a declared secular humanistic rabbi. I love the family parts. I love the getting together parts. I love the holiday. Not so crazy about what you guys say, but I like that part. That was inspiring to me. I think but of course, obviously, this is going to be as varied as the numbers of human beings there are in the world, and certainly the number of secular humanists, because we are a contentious bunch.
So I guess one of the things that I heard, I tend to go that way too. I think ritual is a matter of personal taste, but especially among ex-Christian atheists, there's the idea that ritual especially the rituals that they're used to, sort of enforces this social hierarchy of priests who are above them and who can tell them what they do because they speak for God. How do you get around that, and how do you build a context where that's not the case?
Well, we are lucky in one respect as Jews. There's never been a rabbi who has been invested with all that much authority, but certainly not universally by all the Jews. But more importantly, all of our rituals need to be subject to scrutiny. The Reform movement started in this direction, and in the last 20 to 30 years, they have become disturbingly, in my mind, much more slavish to the old language. As humanistic Jews, we're not interested in the old language. We scrub our services clean of any kind of theistic notions, but more importantly, we create positive experiences that talk about the wonder that we seek in the world, which I'm rereading Richard Dawkins' Unweaving the Rainbow. I want opportunities to unweave the rainbow with them and to explore this. Jewish ritual, to the extent that it assists me in that, whether it's the holidays or life cycles, or I suppose things that are related to them, even Shabbat, if they can enhance my sense of community and allow me to express my wonder at the world and do that with a secular humanistic worldview, then they're meaningful to me. But that's not an authority kind of thing, because I'm doing this with my fellow humanistic Jews. The only thing I bring to the table is I'm a professional who has been given the time to put things together and to create the resources. And I have an education that allows me to pull from sources here and there and to change them, revise them, adapt them. But honestly, the so-called lay people, I don't know if I'm comfortable with that terminology, but the non-rabbis in our movement, they contribute as much as the rabbis do.
You know, last week we had Daniel Dennett on, and he spoke about how, as an atheist, he still was very much drawn to the old language of the old hymns, because it created this very visceral, joyous kind of expression in him. Do you ever get, as a congregational leader, do you ever get sort of that pushback of saying, I want the old tune, I don't want the new words to this new tune, or things like that? And sort of how do you negotiate that?
Well, we as Jews are very fortunate that, at least most of us, that we don't understand one damn thing we're singing half the time. Now, in Israel, it's a different story. But just taking the American Jewish population, they don't know what they're singing when they're singing Adon Olam or when they're singing Micha Mocha or any of these tunes. And in our movement, we like to preserve and adapt things. There's a lovely service for ending the Sabbath, and it's filled with all kinds of mysticism and all kinds of what I would call in Yiddish narishkeit, silliness. But the tune that's become very popular, it's a new one, it's already canonic among liberal Jews. So people wanted to hear it, and they approached me, and they said, could you write a set of blessings that would fit this tune? And that's a new tune. There are tunes on Yom Kippur that people like to hear. I can't take the language and be comfortable with that. But we can rewrite the Hebrew, we can rewrite the English, and we can express things that are our own that are our own integrity, that stem from our integrity, I should say, that are reflect our own ideology. And what I hear Daniel Dennett saying, and unfortunately he probably learned all his songs in English, is that it's evocative. It evokes an emotional response. We are absolutely about that. Because I'm lucky enough to be, and now beginning a new chapter, a humanistic rabbi in a congregation, we don't get pushback on those kinds of things. Occasionally we have an issue, and I'll tell you that one recently arose with one of our communities about the Kaddish. Hmm. The Kaddish is
a memorial prayer.
Right, a memorial prayer, but it's really praising God, just in ways that are beyond the beyond the beyond. People like to hear it, and they especially like to hear it when they don't read the translation. So we had a little pushback on that, and the rabbi of our movement, who's a consultant to many of these congregations, she showed them something that we had written, actually the founder of our movement had written, in nice Aramaic, sounds like the Kaddish, but it's not about the Kaddish. Instead of being about how great God is, it's about how great peace is. And they saw that, and it had the rhythm, and it had the rhyme, and all of the things that they were looking for emotionally, and it didn't violate our ideology and our approach.
So we're getting really close to the time we've got. Like I said, because this is more than just an intellectual interest to me, I'd pick your brain all day on this. But so you're the incoming rabbi at the Birmingham Temple. So what are your plans there?
Well, this is the founding congregation of our movement. It was founded by Sherwin Wine and a small group of people in 1963, who, by the way, was named American Humanist of the Year at one point. My plans there are to, together with them, to explore this crazy idea of how we use our Jewish culture to enhance our secular humanism. There's as many different kinds of viewpoints as you guys have expressed that are, coming to my attention at the congregation. But I think we share, more than anything, we share the idea that humans are the managers down here. We're in charge. If somebody has some kind of deistic thoughts or some kind of thoughts about something out there in the universe, really that's between them and their thoughts. What we're going to concentrate on is the here and the now, the truth of Jewish history, what really happened, not the myth. The myth is lovely, as Homer is lovely, but the myth is not a reflection of the reality. We're going to explore how we celebrate together. We're going to explore how we mourn, how we comfort each other, what we do for the sick, what we do on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. And I think that this congregation, which has been really, it's our largest and our most vital, I think we're going to continue to build. And hopefully we'll be an example for other groups of people, be they groups of Jews or people who grew up in other cultures and other traditions, for how they can put together a community of meaning, what I like to call an expressive community. The other rabbis always talk about their congregations being sacred communities, which, that's not language I'm that into. I like to talk about us being an expressive community. We're going to express our humanism. We're going to behave towards each other in a way that puts a real foundation of glory and honor and respect on this incredible philosophy of secular humanism.
Rabbi Jeffrey Falik is the secular humanistic rabbi. He's incoming at the Birmingham Temple in Farmington Hills, Michigan, and he blogs at theatheistrabbi.com. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
I look forward to talking to you again. This is Ask an Atheist, 253-584-1480. When we come back in a minute, we're going to do a little bit of a post-brief on this, and we're going to talk about cake.
Doyle's Public House is Tacoma's number one spot for the best selection of import brews and Irish whiskey.
Football matches and Red Sox games, knowledge night and no-cover live music.
Doyle's is your spot.
Check us out at doylespublichouse.com or stop by for a proper libation and soda bread at 2nd and St. Helens Avenue in Tacoma.
Like us on Facebook for all the latest updates and specials.
Doyle's in Tacoma.
2nd and St. Helens Avenue in Tacoma. doylespublichouse.com.
So what does everybody want to play?
Something new?
Something with guns. Lots of guns.
Something that supports playing other than combat, you knob.
Jerk face.
All right, how about Dead Stars from Dame and I Publishing? It's a sci-fi game that uses the Universal Decay rules. This system has an emphasis on social and technical skills, yet allows technical characters to make thousands of different weapons.
Hey, psionics.
Oh yeah, I'm gonna be a bug with big freaking guns.
Shape-shifting tech head for me.
Check out DameandI.net for the sci-fi horror game Dead Stars, or to get involved in the community forums.
Dead Stars, now available on Amazon.
So, picking you up at 8 tonight?
Sure.
How do I get to your place again?
Get off the freeway, turn left at the burger joint, past the Humanist Center, right at the...
What? Humanist Center?
Yeah, you know, the place where freethinkers have their meetings, hold events, access the resource library, drop their kids off for daycare.
This could be you and your friends in the near future. Contribute to the Humanists of Washington Humanist Center Fund to establish a physical home for freethinkers in the Puget Sound. Go to humanistsofwashington.org and contribute today. That's humanistsofwashington.org.
I am the Queen of England. You must give me your lunch money.
Why?
Because it'll explode.
I don't know.
I'm the Queen of England. I know things.
Well, that makes sense. Here you go.
Wait, Billy. Just because an authority says it doesn't make it true. Come to Camp Quest Northwest, where you'll learn critical thinking and science in a fun-filled week-long nature camp.
No!
Camp Quest Northwest can be found at campquestnorthwest.org. Donations and volunteers accepted. The devil is not real.
I'm melting!
So you're on your Monday morning drive, and someone on Ask an Atheist says something that really, really gets your goat. You want to talk, you want to yell, you want to scream, and clicking the shiny red candy-like button just isn't good enough. Good! Call us! Leave us a message! Call Ask an Atheist at 206-420-0997 and vent your spleen now and for the future! That's 206-420-0997 and wait for the tone.
Welcome back. This is Ask an Atheist 253-584-1480. And if you like what you just heard and want to hear more of it, and you want to give money to the show, but you want to get something for your money, June 21st at Louis G's at 5219 Pacific Highway East in Fife, we're having the Summer Solstice Music Event with Animals and Cars, Variety Hour, Sleepy Pilot, and Body Box. Tickets are $10 at Brown Paper Tickets or at the door. Again, that's June 21st, 7 p.m. So in the last segment, I feel like I have something I need to answer for, as I thanked him for mentioning a connection to to humanity as a larger population. It feels weird coming out of my mouth, so I feel like I have to speak about it a little bit. Once upon a time, Becky brought me and a friend of the show and stand-up comic Jeremy Whitman to a humanistic Jewish... What kind of ceremony was it?
It was a Tu B'Shvat Seder, which is a little observance and meal commemorating a different harvest time. It's a harvest festival.
Yeah.
You eat a lot of fruit, and each fruit has a deeper meaning.
There's an hour-long story in this about how it went down. It was fun. I had a great time. I met some really awesome people. But there was this one moment that was really awkward for me, is when they were giving... It felt like a homily. I don't know what it was.
A teaching, I might say?
Yeah, teaching or something, yeah. But he said, somebody came up on and said, Jewish people are some of the best people in the world, et cetera, et cetera. You know, and he was talking about that. And then he realized that me and Jeremy were in the room. And he goes, Jewish people, oh yeah, and they're friends too.
It was not quite exactly like that, but that was, it was looking up from your pre-drafted talk and then making eye contact with you guys.
I think you're
and
being
quickly changing it.
I think you think I'm being uncharitable. I think you're being charitable. The truth is probably somewhere in the middle. But it was a really awkward moment for me, and it felt like, it felt like the connection to a larger humanity as a humanist felt like a little bit of an afterthought in that moment. And it was a little weird for me. And it was nice. It was nice to hear somebody make that connection. I wasn't like judging or anything like that. It was just, it provided a contrast for me, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I asked the question about the ghettoizing effect of religious Jewish communities, but one thing that I haven't quite found my home yet is one reason I haven't quite found my home yet within a Jewish cultural community, an intentional community, is because I still sort of feel saddled with an ingrained cultural dedication to the tribe or to, in religious communities, it's chosenness. You're
right.
Chosen by God. In liberal Jewish communities, it's we are chosen, we are separate, not better. And it just sort of persists. I felt like it persists a little bit within secular communities.
I didn't mention it in the interview because I didn't really want our interviewer to answer for that because he wasn't there. So,
I guess the question of whether religious labels of any time give people that sense of I'm separate from everyone else or a sense of superiority. I mean, I've again to looking inwardly.
Yeah.
I've been at atheist groups and seen people say things that are just as jarring and make my teeth kind of go on edge just as much.
Let's be honest. We've had folks on the show with that opinion.
Yeah. I look at it and I hear someone say, oh, well, we're just the smartest people in the world, or we're immune to all of these sort of logical fallacies and all these people are falling. That's a trap. And I think sometimes when we fall into that kind of thinking, it cuts off our ability to be introspective, and it creates a kind of BS arrogance where we somehow forget that we're not immune to these things because we have the same human brain, and that arrogance makes us ironically fall victim to that stuff.
Absolutely.
That I'm so smart, but then everybody believes something dumb.
And that's what it comes down to when you form communities, when you have, you know, when you have a synagogue community and you have the kind of communities that we're forming now in the atheism visibility movement. You can't look at, you can recognize yourself as a culture. You can recognize yourself as, you know, a group of people with a goal. But when you start elevating yourselves above others just because you have an identity, then it gets a little weird for me. And that's, I mean, for any group, for Jews, for atheists, for comic book geeks, for people who like Star Trek.
Well, not comic book geeks. We are better than everyone.
for liberals, conservatives, socialists, libertarians. They all see themselves because of just this mere identity as something, a cut above the rest of everybody else, and the hoi polloi. And I think that's something we really, really have to avoid, and we really have to watch out for, is just because of some social identity, there's that going on.
Actually, one of the things that I really like about participating on this show, Sam, is the relationship I have with the two of you, which is that occasionally we will say things and we disagree on it, and we can actually hash it out. There is never the sense that my poop doesn't stink, and that I'm immune to this sort of thing. I'm just as capable of falling into logical traps as anyone else, and I think a lot of it is when you hear something that you want to be true, do you immediately fall into it? We all do this, and I think that skepticism is work. Skepticism isn't just a label. Skepticism is something you have to do, and I'll hear something that I want to be true. As a skeptic, it's not just, well, I have this initial thought, so I must be true because I have this identity. No. It's a question of, okay, what do I have to do when I hear this claim, especially when I want it to be true? It's something you have to hold on to, not something that you can rest on your laurels with. And I see a lot of groups do that. I don't want to be that.
Making a really important point here is that we may think skepticism is a superior attitude to have to phenomena in the world, but that doesn't make us superior people for using it.
Yeah, we've had listeners email us and say, hey, you were bad skeptics on this particular issue. And that's something that we welcome. We'll push back if we think that their logic is not quite sound, but
it happened to me recently on an article about cold fusion. Is apparently there's a cold fusion generator out there that's been independently verified, and there's a study on Arxiv about it, and I'm like, I'm going to keep my mind open on this one. And then somebody came in and said, well, that's not really, there's a lot of evidence here to suggest that this is a scam, be careful. And and maybe that in that situation it was a case of being a bad skeptic.
And that's the thing we have here, which is that we can actually rely on each other and bounce off each other, and one of us goes down this weird path, another one can say, hey, hold on a minute here, have you considered X?
Yeah.
And I think that's something you need to have, is that when you fall into the road of dogma, where everything is just said, okay, you can't argue with this because an authority figure says this, because a really old book says this, or this important figure in our movement who is never wrong says this.
Yes.
That's the trap. We always have to constantly push against each other because, as somebody once said, truth can only be ascertained through the conflict of ideas.
Nice. So I'm going to have to apologize for jettisoning the cake, but we're running out of time. I do have a quick email, though. This is Chrissy in Afghanistan, and she writes, so here I am in the land of radical Islam, and I have to ask the question, what is the incentive to being atheist? I mean, if I want to convert to Islam, take on the proud heritage of being Muslim, kill the infidel Americans, I'm guaranteed a certain quantity of virgins. Does atheism have some quantity of virgins available for the taking?
Well, not all Muslims say that. There is a significant group that does say that.
Yeah.
But I've always found that kind of weird. The difference is that I'm not trying to sell you magic beans.
Yeah.
I'm not selling you. I'll sell you beans that may taste good, or you can use them for a counting math exercise with children. But in the end, the question is the person making a claim that's true? And on a weird side, that for people who do believe that they're going to get essentially an orgy after they die, are those people who used to be live people and now they're forced into sex servitude? That's always something that really creeps me out.
They don't really talk about that.
I'm not sure either. I'm kind of with you, Mike. I mean, the idea that you know, you're choosing between the different religious you know, preferences or religious orientations, and then you say, well, atheism doesn't offer me any promise, so I'm just going to dump that one because, you know, it's the worst of the... It doesn't give me airline miles. It doesn't give me grocery rewards. It doesn't give me 2% back on my gas purchases.
I would even a step further and say, I mean, look at the United States. Definitely look at Afghanistan. There's not a lot of social value in being an atheist. I'm not an atheist because it gives me a social edge. I'm not an atheist because it makes me a better person in the eyes of others. I'm not an atheist because it gets me a rewards card or anything like that. I'm an atheist because that's what the evidence says, and I follow the evidence. It's a statement more about who I am than where I want to be.
Yeah, it's, again, taking the question of want out of it. Do I believe it because I want it to be true, or do I believe it because I think it actually is?
Yeah.
And the truth is that the magic beans are not going to save you. They're not going to get you into heaven. They're not going to get you 72 or even 80 virgins. It's not like another religion can come along and say, oh, I can give you even more virgins. Like, wow, I can trade up.
Maybe that's the problem. Maybe we need, like, to market it a little bit and say, yeah, you know, as an atheist, you get free Twinkies, and where are you going to get those these days? Or something like that.
I guess we can, if we're going to market it, I think let's market it like this. Atheism, we won't blow smoke up you.
I suppose. I have to admit, I've gotten some weird smoke, you know, weird arguments and stuff like that. Again, atheists are a group of people just like any other. Just because you're an atheist actually doesn't mean you're a skeptic. So sometimes you're going to run into the atheist with the magic beans.
And we have.
And boy... Have we?
We have. I think that, yeah, I mean, you can lack a belief in God, but still believe in a whole lot of other funny things, or be convinced of funny things if you're not careful. So
yeah,
conspiracy theorists, pseudoscience, you name it.
And soon, and this is one I really want to take on, where there's coming a point now where very quickly we're going to be talking about GMO foods. There's a lot there. There's a lot that's weird. There's a lot that, you know, that needs to be talked about.
Even in our community.
And that's all the time we have for today. My name is Sam. With me was Rebecca Friedman and Mike Gillis. Thank you very much, Jeffrey Falick. As usual, our music is by Chris Coleman, Phil Whitfield, and Steve Siemens. Our post show is at Doyle's at 5 p.m. You can call us at 206-420-0997 or email us at questions@askanatheisttv.tv. See you next week.
Clay Radio, your conversation station.